Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, I am excited to welcome my very first international guest to the podcast today. She hails from Scotland, but now calls Auckland, New Zealand home, and that's where she's speaking to us from today. Her name is Laura Braid, and she's a psychologist with a private practice and a fascinating story about how she came to do the work that she does today. Welcome, Laura.
Hi.
Lovely to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to share this time with you.
It's very cool. Now, Laura, you started out as a forensic psychologist in Scotland, working in the prison system there.
I did.
Can you tell us a bit about the work that you did there and how it led you to start your practice, which is gorgeously named The Sweet Life, all the way over on the other side of the world?
Okay, so I was brought over to New Zealand in 2005 by the Department of Corrections here in New Zealand. And I came here to work as a forensic psychologist. And what I was doing here was basically working from a very strengths-based positive psychology model and an ACT model with offenders. So I was designing and facilitating high-risk sexual offender treatment programs. And these programs had these strengths-based and ACT processes underpinning them. And we were seeing some really promising anecdotal results with the offenders by working in this way with them. And then it struck me that, you know, there was very little provision being made at the time. This is around, you know, 2007, 2008, to work with our more general population like you and I in this way. So I was lying in the bath one night, had this epiphany, called my dad in Scotland and said, do you think I should do this? And my dad's very entrepreneurial and he's like, go for it. Absolutely go for it. So I decided to brave the world of private practice and try and bring these really wonderful, powerful processes to the general population.
Wonderful. And you named your practice The Sweet Life.
I did. So again, back in this time, when I was working within the prisons and also coming into private practice, I noticed that regardless of whether I was, you know, working with people in prison, new mums, stressed out corporates, or people just like you and I, we all were looking and seeking for that same thing. And one of the most fundamental and desired human experiences that we have as humans is connection. So living that connected and engaged life is what we really want for ourselves. So ultimately, we're kind of looking to live that good life, or as they say colloquially in New Zealand, the sweet life.
Uh-huh. So it's actually got a New Zealand flavour to it.
A little bit of a New Zealand connection. So for me, that psychological sweet life is where we learn to accept the good with the bad, the pleasant with the distressing, and the awesome with the terrible, and everything else in between. So if we can learn to do this, it helps us to lead a life that's more engaged, more meaningful, more mindful, and ultimately more connected. But in saying that, like everything in life, things evolve, and at the moment I'm currently evolving my brand, so to speak. So there is a little bit of watch the space with the sweet life at the minute.
Okay. Well, that's exciting in itself. Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about that connectedness, and I actually was really, really fortunate to see Martin Seligman, the father of positive psychology, speak last night in Melbourne. I went to he was presenting for the School of Life, and he opened by saying that he gave a little story about a dream that he'd had, one of those anxiety dreams about not about having to sit an exam that you hadn't studied for. I think probably any of those of us, maybe even just through high school, but certainly many years of university, it's an ongoing. And he's 75 years old, so he's still having those anxiety dreams about not having studied for an exam. And when he woke up, he said he started out feeling anxious, but he then quickly realized, he was sort of able to reframe it, and he realized that my life makes sense now. And that was sort of how he opened this whole conversation about his history and psychology and where he'd come to with this phrase, my life makes sense. And I think that really, it sounds a lot like what you're talking about there, that connectedness, that feeling engaged, that being able to take the good with the bad, the struggles with the joys, and feeling that life makes sense.
Absolutely. There's a very big picture, and we tend to get caught up and hooked in by the stuff that gets in the way of that big picture. And that's ultimately what I try to help my clients with, is to live the big picture, to actually be open and willing and curious enough to see what are the pixels that make up that big picture, if that makes sense.
It does. And I'm going to come to more of that in a moment and ask you how you do that. But just going back to those prisoners in the prison system, and you said you came at it from a strengths basis and a positive basis. How does that differ perhaps to how prisoners and I know a lot of other clinical work is done traditionally?
Well, I think we tend to pathologize a lot, and we tend to look for, you know, what's not going so well for us. And what was really interesting about the work that I was doing back then with the offenders was that, you know, these people and guys in particular that I was working with, they're a holistic person, they're a being, and there's so much more to them than just the offence they've committed. And so to have someone come in and offer them a space and to hold a space for them to see what else makes up who they are, and to allow them to acknowledge what they've done, but and to be able to then see where they can go from here. Because ultimately, most of these guys do get released back into our community. Therefore, let's teach them strengths. Let's teach them what their strengths are, and get them to focus on them rather than what has maybe led to them leading that life that they had in the past, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. Yes. And I think I'm obviously, you know, beholden to that philosophy too, in terms of, you know, especially working in workplaces. But I think for somebody who is perhaps, and I've had this conversation from my own small experience with prisons and the prison system about the nature of offenders, and the fact that we do as a society tend to see anybody who's been in that situation as being, that's it, that's their label, that's who they are. And I can understand that if people take that on themselves, if the offenders take that on themselves and never get a chance to explore anything else, then it really does make it hard to change.
Exactly. And hopefully we get a chance later to talk a little bit more about, you know, that conceptualized self and how there's much more to us than the I statements that we use about ourselves.
Yeah. So now you are working with members of the general population, the general public. Who are the sorts of people who would come to see you in your practice on a daily basis?
So I have a real mixture between male and female clients, and I also see a lot of younger adults as well. But I have a few different hats that I wear. I have, you know, my general practice, which people can self-refer to, or I have referrals from GPs and psychiatrists, and that may be people who are experiencing anxieties or depression, some personality disorder work. And I also have a contract where I work with people who have potentially suffered a mental injury as a result to sexual abuse. So I provide an approved provider position with ACC, which is our accident corporation here in New Zealand, accident compensation rather. And they have funding available under sensitive claims to help people be assessed, diagnosed and treated for any mental injury that they may have suffered. So I do a lot of work in that area. So I have come from a forensic background, and I'm now on that flip side of working with people who have survived abuse. So it's a really humbling and a very honour position that I have to be able to do that. And I also do some employee assistance work as well. So I work with people in the workplace and organisations to try and help them, you know, facilitate some change that may be happening as a result of the context of the work situation, or, you know, the personal stuff that we bring into the work situation.
Okay. And you said that something about being very humbled, and we ask all of our guests to write a little blurb about themselves before they come onto the show, and how they've developed the passion for what they do. And in yours you wrote, "My clients inspire and challenge me every day to step up in my world, to own and be okay with owning my vulnerabilities." And I just thought that was beautiful. Can you tell us a little more about that?
I just think we've got such a privileged role as psychologists or therapists, mental health workers, to have or to be able to have someone sit in front of us and to go through that therapy process. It takes so much courage. And I believe that courage is the core value that allows us to live any other values we may have or may be important to us. And to me, our clients, my clients, have courage in bucket loads. Like they just step up constantly. And I just find that inspiring. And to observe someone giving themselves permission time and time and time again to be vulnerable in order to move towards or to shift in some way to a life that's more valued life. You know, I think that's a true honour, and it's absolutely what I enjoy the most about being a psychologist.
It's a wonderful way to frame it too, I think. And so how has this played out for you? You said it in terms of being able to step up on your own life. What, taking that courage that you see from your clients, how have you allowed that to play out in your life?
Well, even just doing this with you today, like I'm a normal human and I feel anxiety, and you know, like even thinking about having to do this today, preparing for doing this today, all of this stuff just creates a normal anxiety. But what I'm doing with you now and sharing this information and views and opinions and discussion is so important to me and I'm so passionate about what I do. But I'm willing to sit with that. I'm willing to be vulnerable. I'm willing to allow that to be there in order to get somewhere, to grow, to flourish, to be me, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I can completely relate to that, because the very process, I suppose, of creating the podcast series, of interviewing and doing what it takes to get to that, it really is about stepping outside of that comfort zone, allowing yourself to do something, but driven by a sense of purpose and passion, which, you know, has been very much the driver for me, you know, and I think when we talk about purpose and this idea that it's contributing something to larger than ourselves, then I know for me, I can kind of put myself aside a little bit in this process and say, you know what, this is not about me, you know, there's stuff that I need to do, but this is about my guests. This is about giving them the opportunity to share their passion. This is about giving them the opportunity and giving the, you know, our listeners the opportunity to hear and take hold of this wonderful expertise and knowledge and these ideas in order to fulfill their own potential in their lives. So yeah, I don't think I'd really thought about it in terms of that courage and vulnerability and that link perhaps to what psychologists do in a practical setting, if they're seeing individual clients and kind of taking that forward in our own lives. I just thought that was lovely.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us, in terms of the sorts of things that you work with clients on, I know that mindfulness is a real passion of yours and a real driving force in your practice, and I'm guessing also in your everyday life. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell our listeners, because there's lots of stuff out there about mindfulness and we're all mindful about this, that and the other, and it's, you know, the great, perfect solution to all the problems. But from a psychological point of view, what does mindfulness actually mean?
You're right. There's so, it's such a buzzword at the minute, and there's so many different ways of trying to explain it. But my most basic understanding of being mindful is where we notice and bring awareness to our thoughts, our physiological sensations, our emotions, our senses, and the environment around us as it is happening in the present moment without judging it. So for me, mindfulness becomes a way of living, and a bit like ACT, which we are hopefully speaking about a little bit later, it becomes almost like a lifestyle practice. So each moment that I become aware of, I try to allow myself permission to be in it, to notice it, to breathe into it, to make room for it, and to allow it to be there as it is. So whether that be noticing my thoughts, becoming aware of my feelings, smelling my coffee, savouring the taste of my wine tonight, noticing the way my daughter's nose crinkles when she speaks, it's the permission for these experiences to be there as they are without trying to change them in any way. And I think that mindfulness practice can be formal or informal. The formal practice that I like to use and I use a lot with my clients is a guided meditation practice, which I completely encourage your listeners to contemplate and have a think about and try. There are some loads and loads of really good apps out there to help people along that journey. Or it can be really informal mindfulness, like I mentioned already. Formal is no better than informal, in my opinion. Being mindful is the important thing. Whatever shape or form that occurs in is almost irrelevant. Getting too fixed and rigid and inflexible goes against the process in itself. So I suppose simply mindfulness allows us to really acknowledge the moment. The moment is the only one we ever really truly have. You know, all we're guaranteed is this very moment that we're in. So I say mindfulness lets us notice that. So let's notice it.
And enjoy it. And what interests me about that, Laura, is, and I think perhaps the bit that doesn't get discussed so much in all of the public general conversation about mindfulness that's going on at present, is the without judgment piece. Mm. You know, we talk about savouring our coffee or being mindful in the moment. But this idea of without judgment, how does that work? You know, in terms of what goes on in our minds, what do we stop judging, for example?
Well, I think when we start to notice that there's any attachment to it, that's when we're not being mindful anymore, because we're actually caught up in the mind again. It doesn't have to be, you know, a negative thing, but it's taking us away from the experience rather than anything. It's being able to stand back and observe the experience for what it is the important part of mindfulness, I think.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of the sorts of thoughts that somebody might get caught up in?
Well, for example, I noticed this morning, I was doing some meditation earlier this morning, and even now with me, who I've been doing this for a long, long time, I still have thoughts that pop into my head of, I'm not doing this well this morning, I'm not doing this right, or I'm really good at this morning. any of those judgments that come in, they get in the way of the experience. And I suppose it's about us noticing when that happens and then making a choice, a mindful choice in that moment of whether it's helpful or not. Is it actually taking us towards what we want to get from this, or is it taking us away from what's important?
Mm. And that helpfulness question, you know, that's something I try to encourage people to is to examine, you know, is it helpful for me to think like this? Is it helpful for me to allow these thought patterns to take me down a path that might make me feel angry, upset, unsettled, sad, you know, because that is our mind and our feelings taking over. Whereas if we can disconnect from all of that and just be in the moment, as you say, then we don't have all of that kind of negative, potentially negative response.
Yeah, I ask myself that question tens of times a day. Do you know, is this helpful? Is it workable? Is it making things unworkable for me? Is it making, you know, what's my intention in this moment? And am I actually allowing that to happen?
Yeah, yeah. The sorts of examples that come to my mind, I suppose, are where perhaps, you know, at the play, well, my kids are getting a little bit bigger now, but even when they want you to watch them doing something, you know, watch me on the trampoline, watch me on my, and you sit there and you go, oh, yeah, okay, watching, yes, but should really be putting the washing out, should really be doing the dishes. Okay, when can I escape this?
I know.
Can I move on and do something else? Mm-hmm. And yeah, for me, it is that kind of noticing your thinking, noticing those thoughts and saying, you know what, this is, all I'm doing is getting myself frustrated here. Yeah. I may as well just sit and enjoy watching them on the trampoline or enjoy the feeling of the sun on my back or enjoy being outside.
And each moment that we choose to do that, it's not a permanent thing. Like, we have to consciously make that decision all the time. Do you know, it's not something that we just achieve and tick off the list. We really have to consciously be committed to being more mindful or being less judgmental of ourselves or whatever it may be. And that's the important thing underneath all of this, is that, you know, nothing's permanent. We have to keep moving towards. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what are the benefits of doing this? I mean, we sort of touched on what some of the benefits might be, but if you have a client in, you know, who's struggling with a bit of anxiety or stress, how do you sell them, I suppose, this idea of incorporating mindfulness into their day?
Well, I suppose that my biggest aim in any session is for someone to realize that they're so much bigger than any thought or any feeling or any physiological sensation they may have. And ultimately, anxiety is the example that you've just used. Is, you know, on the most basic of levels, it's layers and layers and layers of physiological sensation that make up this construct of anxiety, this emotion. And when we overly identify with that, we lose sight of how big we actually are, and we think the anxiety is going to get bigger than us. It never will get bigger than us. But the only way for us to really be able to see and feel and experience that is if we're able to use mindfulness in a way to notice our thoughts, notice our feelings, notice that where that anxiety sits in our body, to objectify in some way, to visualize in some way, to see and get perspective on it as an observer, that it's not bigger than us. It is transient. It's not going to last forever. And mindfulness is a very powerful process that allows us to do that.
Yeah, yeah, because we know that what we focus on grows. So if we focus on the anxiety, it does just grow.
Absolutely. Yep.
Again, that process, I suppose, of examining what's going on in our minds, what's going on in our bodies, being able to disconnect from that to allow it to not grow and overwhelm us, to just sit and be.
Once these thoughts, beliefs, schemas, emotions, once they're heard, because they're all valid in some shape or form, once they feel as though they've been heard, they kind of just skulk off and they just kind of stage left, off they go.
Yeah. The power of therapy, just being able to acknowledge in a outside of our own minds, I suppose, to somebody else that this is what we're thinking, feeling, and then it doesn't have the hold over us that it did prior.
Yeah.
I like the idea of them skulking off.
Actually uses lots of metaphors, and my mind, so I've got a very visual mind, so it works really well for me, and I literally have images in my mind of my thoughts just kind of skulking off the side of the stage.
You're not helping me, off you go.
I love that. So we've talked a bit about mindfulness. One of the other kind of, I suppose in psychology, we'd call it a modality, you know, fancy word for things that you do, is ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, which people may have heard of because, again, like you said earlier, it's becoming more one of those sort of lifestyle things, not just therapy things. Can you explain again for our listeners what ACT is and how it works?
Yeah. Bit of brief history of behavioural cognitive models. ACT is considered a third wave. And the first wave, you know, happened, you know, many years ago, and we had that kind of hardcore behavioural therapy approach modality. And then the second wave came along and introduced a more cognitive element to the model and gave us what we now know to be cognitive behavioural model. And then, you know, maybe in the late 1990s, early 2000s, we started to evolve into what we call now this third wave, and ACT fits in with this third wave. And it's based on a really complex theory called relational frame theory, which I'm absolutely and definitely not going to go into.
Too complex.
Way too complex. But what it really basically allows us to see is the relationship to the thoughts and the emotions that we have, rather than just the content of them, which, you know, that more cognitive model gave us. And the research within relational frame theory and ACT suggests that many of the tools that we use to solve problems actually lead us into traps that create suffering, for want of a better word. And one of the biggies is the human mind itself and our ability, that wonderful, beautiful ability that we have as humans to use language. So the aim of ACT is to increase what we call psychological flexibility. And ACT is a psychological intervention or a modality, as you mentioned, that's based around a set of methods or processes that are focused on a model called psychological flexibility.
Okay, so what does psychological flexibility look like?
this is the tricky bit. But before we chat about how to increase psychological flexibility, it may be helpful for us to quickly understand what psychological inflexibility is.
Good idea, yep.
So if you're okay with me doing that. So psychological inflexibility is what we call experiential avoidance. So in a real basic nutshell, it is what us humans do. We don't like the thoughts we're having, or we're distressed by how we feel. So we take action to eliminate these thoughts and feelings. So we get tangled up and hooked in by the content of our mind. And it's being caught up in the past and worrying and living in a future that hasn't even happened yet. It's where we're having difficulty connecting with what is actually happening in the context of now. And we end up choosing behaviours that aren't deep down in line with what really matters to us and who we really are and who we want to be. So in order to deal with all of this inflexibility, we try to control. And control is a big issue that we us humans have. We try to avoid and push away, get rid of thoughts and emotions. And we get into this place where we're thinking, similar to what you just mentioned earlier, actually, we get into this place where we're thinking that we're pushing the subtraction button on that metaphorical calculator, but what we're inadvertently doing is banging away the multiplication button. We're making matters worse. And here's the absolute clanger in my world. This just kind of blows my mind. So life continuously offers situations where we're likely to feel what society and cultures have taught us to believe are negative emotions. It's a fact that life throws us negative stuff. So the only way to truly avoid these experiences is to not have a life. You know, we have to stop being human. And these negative experiences are a natural part of our human experience. And they can at times be really, really valuable. They let us know that we're normal, for instance, that things may be amiss, that we even miss somebody, or we may have lost someone. And I remember a few years ago, I was at this training with Robin Walser. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's the most wonderful ACT trainer. And she once quoted, which stuck in my mind, "When suffering knocks at your door and you say there is no seat for him, he tells you not to worry because he's brought his own stool." Yeah? It's, in other words, it's like, you don't have to like or want your guests, in inverted commas, thoughts or feeling. It's about letting them be there. They won't stay for too long, but and definitely don't be surprised if they keep coming back and knocking your door time and time again, because that is life. That is what life is. And I think when we notice this inflexibility that we have, it then allows us to make a choice to be more flexible. And I suppose that's what where psychological flexibility then comes in. So psychological flexibility, and in real normal everyday language, this is where we hold our own thoughts and our emotions a little less tightly. So we hold them a little bit more lightly, and we act on or move towards our bigger picture values. So we move towards being and living what deep down in our heart really matters most to us, rather than feeling that need and that urge to react urgently to short-term, transient and permanent thoughts and feelings.
So, and that was a wonderful explanation. Thank you. I think the thing that really strikes me about this is the acceptance part of it, just accepting that we are human, that bad things will happen, that things will hurt, that things will make us feel vulnerable or sad or frustrated. And a little like we were saying before, just accepting that is, and by accepting it, it does allow it to skulk off stage left rather than trying to, because I think for me, and I'm just trying to kind of process that, you know, what you've said and think about it in terms of my own experience. But if we try to hold tightly to these things, or we try to avoid them, avoid those feelings, I don't want to think about that, you know, fight that I'm going to have with a partner, or I don't want to think about the fact that when I send my children off to school, something awful could happen to them, or, you know, these things that pop into our heads.
Yeah.
And rather than trying to push them away or avoid them or get ourselves uptight about them, just allowing them to kind of wash in, go, okay, this is being human.
Yeah.
And then let them wash away. It strikes me that there's some similarities to self-compassion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the thing, like the really cool thing about ACT is that it's based around really powerful change processes. And there are six processes that are fundamental to ACT. And as an ACT therapist, that is what we do, is we try to build psychological flexibility through these six processes. And it's really worth noticing here, Ellen, as you just kind of alluded to, we're human beings too. And that psychological flexibility applies as much to the clinician in sessions as it does to the client, because we're ultimately two humans having a conversation, and we're trying to build our own psychological flexibility and our clients. And it's our job as therapists to be able to notice that and do that as well.
Mm. And I can imagine too, because even for me, you know, I don't do therapeutic work, but I do coaching work, which, you know, similar sort of processes, just done with different population of people. Mm. And there's always that little kind of train of thought that's going through in your mind, because you have to be present in that conversation. But at the same time, there's always the little thing that goes, you're doing this wrong. That wasn't the right question. What happens if, you know, this person gets angry with me? What happens if, you know, and being allowed to let go of all of those thoughts. And I suppose to a little bit, you know, to some extent, trust your judgment in the moment, trust your instincts, and just allow you to roll with it. And I'd not really thought about that, is actually practicing psychological flexibility as you do it. And I can think of so many applications, you know, for me as a workplace psychologist, managers having to have difficult conversations with a staff member or do a presentation, you know, those of us who have stood up in front of a big group and had to do a presentation where there's this little dialogue going, oh my goodness, I've lost my train of thought, or I don't know what to say next, or I don't know that they're understanding what I'm saying. And again, being, you know, not getting fixated on those ideas, because we know, especially if you're standing up in front of a group, that doing so does not help you.
No, definitely not.
It makes it a whole lot worse.
Yeah. But it's like what I was saying earlier about how, you know, society and our cultures have kind of taught us and led us to believe that these feelings are negative, when the reality is they help motivate us in times as well. And as we were saying earlier about our values, it really helps to feel these things in order to motivate us to do what's important to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about this as a lifestyle approach, I suppose, ACT being a lifestyle approach. How do you, you know, if you were talking to a non-client, you know, just perhaps your own children even, what are the sorts of ideas that you would want to teach people in order that they could kind of grasp this stuff and run with it and implement it in their own lives?
The six processes that I was talking about, psychological flexibility, would you like me to go?
Yes, that'd be great.
This is how we actually do psychological flexibility. So the easiest way to visualize these six processes, if you think of it a bit like a 3D hexagon, and we refer to this in ACT as a hexaflex.
Hexaflex, what a great term, hexaflex. Yes.
So it's basically this visual representation of what psychological flexibility is. So all of these processes are connected and supported by each other, and there's no correct order for focusing on them, but this is what I would be jumping in and out of in any particular session with a client, or whether it be trying to work through a problem that my daughters are having, or a friend, or myself. This is the processes that I kind of work from in my mind. So there's no particular order to these, but the first one I'll talk about is acceptance, because we've already mentioned that. So acceptance is a quite a tricky word to introduce, and I don't mean acceptance in the terms of tolerance or resignation. I mean in the true sense of the word, to receive and get present with. So acceptance is introduced and taught as an alternative to the experiential avoidance that we mentioned earlier. So this is where we try to develop and enhance our willingness to allow ourselves to sit with our private experiences, or you know, our thoughts and our feelings. And like as I was saying earlier, so for example, someone who with anxiety, someone that comes to see me with anxiety, I try to teach them to feel anxiety as a feeling, as a completely normal emotion, fully and without defence. Or someone who comes to see me with chronic pain, I try to give them methods to encourage them to let go of the struggle with the pain, rather than trying to avoid or get rid of the pain. So this process of acceptance doesn't get rid of the anxiety, it doesn't get rid of the pain, but what it does do is it allows us to give up the struggle and it allows us to be there in the moment, because the reality, sort of allows those emotions to be there in the moment, because the reality is that they are there in that moment. Does that make sense?
It does.
So one of the other processes we go through is cognitive diffusion. So these are all quite, you know, psychologists have fancy terms for things, but basically this process is just trying to help us change the way we interact and relate to the content of our mind. So there's lots and lots of processes within diffusion that we use in sessions, but a really helpful example that I use all day in, day out is labelling my process of thinking. So saying to myself, or what I was absolutely doing before we started this podcast, is having those thoughts of, I'm not good enough, you know? So I say to myself, I'm having the thought that I'm not good enough, or I notice I'm having the thought that I'm not good enough. And diffusion allows us to basically just to notice and observe our thinking. And it's quite a radical shift in context, because where we observe our thoughts as a word, sentences, images, or pictures in our mind, rather than literal and absolute truths that need to be acted upon or reacted to.
So that idea that we are not our thoughts.
Exactly. We're so much more than that, so much more. But we do. We kind of tend to define ourselves on the thoughts that we have. And a common result of being able to diffuse and being able to be that observer is that we create a bit of distance and we decrease the believability and our attachment to it. Another process is being present, which is the mindfulness bit. And this is where we try to build our awareness. And we've kind of talked about this already. It's about being a moment, being aware of the moment, in the moment that we're in. And the goal here is to have us experience the world more directly so our behaviour can be more flexible. And hopefully our behaviour is then more consistent with what values we really the values that we really hold close to our heart. Self as context is another one of the processes, and that's it's really tricky to explain this verbally, and it may be a bit easier for us to try and to experience this. So we all have a thinking self. So that's the part of our mind that thinks, it rationalizes, it judges and analyzes. And for most of us, we kind of know that bit works really, really well, almost too well sometimes. But, you know, how much do we actually tap into the observer self, that pure awareness that we have? So I don't know, Ellen, if just for a second, you can just maybe notice where your body touches the chair that you're sitting on. Notice where your tongue is in your mouth. Notice the sounds that you can hear outside the room right now. So your thinking self has likely kicked in and will ask the questions. So where is my tongue in my mouth right now? What can I hear outside? But that teeny tiny moment of awareness where we just notice and we're just aware of where the tongue is in our mouth or what sounds we can hear outside, that's what I'm talking about. That is that self as context. That's that sense of us knowing that there's way more to us than how the thoughts that we define ourselves with is. If we're, regardless of how we identify that conceptualized self, even in a moment we were hooked in by thoughts or I'm boring or I'm stupid, this self as context process is independent of that. And it allows us to let go of some of those really unhelpful self-evaluations and still retain a sense of self.
Okay, so it's almost what it reminds me a little bit, I suppose, because I've practiced yoga now for many, many years, and it reminds me of that process of being able to connect with the physical body at the same time as kind of letting go of the thoughts, which is a big part of yoga, you know, having that and it's mindfulness and it's all of these things, you know, have lovely intersection, don't they, of different approaches to come at the same sorts of ideas. But yeah, that physical context. And I know the most useful form of mindfulness, I suppose, in a more formal meditation type sense, actually been sound meditation. It's actually listening to, you know, when I realize that I can listen to what's going on around me, that there is sound. I don't know. Yeah. And I suppose, is that kind of getting at what that self as context is?
Absolutely.
That I'm existing in the world.
Yeah.
Out of my head.
And do you know that sound example that you give, I find that really powerful because, and similarly to you, I find that type of meditation very powerful because we really notice that our ears stay open and receptive to sound. They don't fold over and close in on themselves and shut and avoid and get rid of all the sounds that are around us. They stay open and willing and you know, willing to be there. And when we are able to notice that there's more to us than the I statements that we use, there has to be. There's, you know, there's so much going on within our bodies, within our minds. There's so many different parts of our minds. I think it's just really powerful to acknowledge and tune in a little bit more, turn the volume up a little bit more on that observer self. And that's ultimately what we're explaining there is the self as context process.
Hmm.
And then this all ties in with our values. And that's what's really, beautiful about ACT. And it's what many people believe to be at the very core of the ACT model. So our values are, you know, like that internal compass that guide us. And whether you call them values or just, you know, living life according to deep down what's important to you, they're at the core. But they can be quite tricky and quite abstract for people to define. But values are very different from goals. They're very different from the rules or morals that we live our life by. And I listened to a podcast recently where Stephen Hayes, who's one of the founding gurus in ACT.
Wonderful. I've listened to him on podcasts as well. It is wonderful to listen to.
So amazing. And he described them as adverbs. So there are qualities of being and doing. And I just thought that was wonderful. Like they're very dynamic. They're constantly moving, constantly shifting position. And another ACT guru, a fellow Australian citizen, Russ Harris, he's got a wonderful metaphor that he uses, and he explains our values like continents on a globe. Have you heard him describe that?
I haven't, no.
No, it's really cool. So he talks about how, you know, our values are like the continents on a globe of the world. So no matter how fast we spin that globe, you can never see all the continents at once. There are always some at the front and there are always some at the back. And from moment to moment, you get to choose. We have a mindful choice point of which values come to the front and which ones move to the back. Mm. And that really kind of helps to allow me, again, visual mind, to see that our values do shift. They're dynamic and they're not set in stone. And each context that we're presented or each situation that we are in, we're allowed to. We've got permission to change what's most important to us in that moment and to, you know, try to be more mindful, to make a decision to take us towards what's important in that particular moment.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I had a moment last night when I was heading off. I'd had a coaching session with amazing, incredible working mum who's busy forging ahead in her career. And we did talk about values because I know for a lot of working mothers, there is always that tension between I love my career and what I do and where I contribute to a bigger world, but I also love my family. And sometimes the two, it's hard to marry them together. Mm. And I had, you know, was going off to see Martin Seligman speak. So I was in Melbourne, which is 100 kilometres from home. My husband was doing a fabulous job here with the kids. He'd picked them up from school. And I was thinking about her and thinking, oh, you know, that is a real tension, you know, that you're not there to pick the kids up from school and do the dinner routine because you're at late meetings and what have you. And I thought, oh, actually, that's me right now too. And sort of thought it through that way. And again, those tensions between the values of really wanting to be a present and engaged parent, but also wanting to be someone who is able to live out, you know, what they're passionate about in terms of their career and how they give back to their community. So that idea of, because there is, you know, tension there, but if you think about it as that spinning globe, if you think about it as, you know, in this moment, I am going to live out my psychologist contributor to my profession role, that value, and then I will come home and I will be the present parent and about that value because the globe has spun and I have chosen to spin the globe in that moment.
And that absolutely nails and brings together the whole crux of ACT is that acceptance and commitment therapy. And that's exactly what we talk about here, is that there's always going to be internal and external barriers that get in the way of our values or whatever. And choosing a value direction isn't a permanent thing. The choice has to be made again and again and again. And ACT helps us to prepare for the difficult feelings and thoughts that will likely show up. And it teaches us to be more willing to make room and allow those thoughts and feelings to be there in order for us to keep moving in a direction that's important. So you nailed that process last night.
And I didn't even know I was doing it.
No, you did.
And what was interesting about that was it was actually me reflecting on somebody else's experience that prompted that process for myself.
And isn't that the real beauty of being a therapist as well? Is that you learn so much about ourselves from our clients actually formulating a lot of their own stuff themselves, because that's what they do. And then they throw it back out there and you're like, oh, hang on a minute, you've just managed to meet my issue that I would be facing for the last two nights or whatever it may be.
We're all so human.
Exactly. We are absolutely human. 100%.
Okay. Look, that was a wonderful description. That has helped me so much in terms of, you know, understanding more about the ACT process. For our listeners who are interested in finding out more, because this is, as we said, you know, as much an everyday life thing as a clinical therapy thing, what are some of the most accessible, I suppose, resources that people could find? Books?
Books in particular to ACT? Yeah. I would say a real amazing starting point for anybody would be any of Russ Harris's books. He's got a wonderful ability of being able to take really complex constructs and models and put them into a language that people just get. Mm-hmm. Robin Walser, she also has some really wonderful books out there describing the ACT core processes, in particular to trauma and also couples. She does a lot of couples work. The Association for Contextual Behavioural Science, I'm not too sure if the general public can join that. I think they can, but it's definitely a resource for us as clinicians to be. I would definitely suggest that we join up with the association. But yeah, my biggest vice is buying books, and I have to hide them. You know, women hiding shoes and new jeans and stuff. I hide books from my husband. We've got more books. But yeah, it's a love of mine, and there's lots of really good books out there to help. There's also one that I've read recently that I would really recommend is Susie Redding, a fellow Australian. She's written a book recently called The Self-Care Revolution, and that's a really wonderful resource for us being able to normalize self-care and realize just how important self-care is for us.
Okay. I will put links to all of those in the show notes. There was one other topic that I really wanted to cover kind of quickly, because we don't have a whole lot of time now. And that is, you also have a passion for the role of nutrition in mental health and wellbeing. Can you tell us a little bit about where nutrition fits in?
Okay. So for me, my interest stemmed from a personal issue. I developed some autoimmune conditions after I gave birth to my eldest daughter. And then we as a family had to navigate some really murky waters of food allergies with myself and my two daughters. So I'd always been aware through training as a psychologist of the connection between the brain and the gut, and how those, you know, enteric and central nervous systems talk to each other. So on the most basic of levels, it always made sense to me that there's a connection between what we absorb or what we eat and our mental health. So I attended some professional development training around the same time as I was on maternity leave with a lady called Dr. Julia Rutledge. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's played a key role in nutrition and mental health research here in New Zealand. And she discussed how poor nutrition is a significant and modifiable risk factor for the development of mental illness. And that just further sparked an interest for me. And I suppose the whole nutritional psychology and psychiatry research field is something that I'm watching with great interest and hope. And it's growing at a real rapid pace, that, you know, that link between nutrition and mental health. And whether it's, you know, whether it be just improving and balancing our mood or even to the point of avoiding or treating or lessening mental illness, you know, alongside conventional treatments, I think that optimizing our nutrition is completely safe, and it's possibly a very viable way of helping with mental health. There's definitely more research needed, but on the most basic of levels, to me, it makes sense to nourish our body and our mind with really good nutrient-rich foods. There's definitely loads and loads of questions still to be answered. We need to learn more about the role that genetics play or epigenetics. We need to really, truly try and understand what role our gut health does play and how to improve our gut health. But one thing for me, Ellen, is that has absolutely been answered, is that nutrition matters and our mental health matters, and we need to take the role of nutrition seriously within our mental health and within our mental health system. I think it's a basic fundamental thing that we should be incorporating into our basic mental health care, because, you know, our life isn't linear and our mental health isn't linear. It's normal. It's just as normal as our physical health. We need to take this stuff more seriously. We can't become complacent with our mental health.
Yeah. And so I guess what you're saying there is that it's not yet a silver bullet. It's not like eat these superfoods and you will, you know, be mentally well, but really that underlying. And it's interesting because this has come through in a number of the conversations that I've had with our colleagues, particularly in the areas of well-being and positive psychology, that exercise, diet, sleep are all kind of underpinning things that really can do no harm in moderate levels, you know, without going nuts about it. Yeah. And I think probably in my mind, the thing around nutrition is, again, and it ties into the conversation we've just been having, that it's not about setting up all these rules for yourself about that, that actually make life more complex.
Absolutely.
And make life, you know, that much harder, but it's just having that awareness. And particularly, and in my last episode, I was talking to Jules Clancy about, because she does, you know, she's into simplicity and minimalism and talking about the role food that plays. And we talked about the test and learn process and just that observing in ourselves of, when I eat this stuff, I feel better. Or when I drink coffee too late at night, I don't sleep well. Or, you know, so just at that core level around our well-being, of paying attention to what we eat, how it makes us feel, whether that's good and useful, or whether, like we were saying before, that's unhelpful and doing more of what works and less of what doesn't.
Exactly. And it really, I mean, sometimes I kind of have to sit with the discomfort of saying these things to clients, because it sounds a bit like the advice their granny would give them. Sleep more, you need to eat a little bit better, you know? But it's so true. These are the core elements of being a functioning human, and of course it's so interrelated that of course it makes sense to see the link between these things. And there's a load of research that still needs to be done, and I can only imagine how difficult it is to clinically run trials to prove these things.
Yeah.
And we're a long way away, but as I say, if there's no harm being done and optimizing our nutritional intake is safe and it's a viable way of doing things, then absolutely, let's try it.
Yeah. Well, if it makes you feel any better, I get up in workplaces and tell people to get all primary school and set themselves a bedtime, so you're not the only one.
That too.
Laura, really quickly, just your top three tips. I mean, we probably touched on a lot of it already, but your top three tips for well-being and happiness for our audience. What would you advise?
Okay, so I'm a big believer in what we do often is, you know, what has the biggest positive impact on our mental health. So other than what I've said already about mindfulness, in no particular order, I would say, you know, focus on your strengths. Keep sight of what's going well, what you're good at. Acknowledge, obviously, what isn't going well, but again, hold it lightly. These, you know, strength tests are available online for free. Go on, try them, figure out. If you don't know what your strengths are, go on and take some tests and see what they may be. Connection. I'm a huge believer in connection, and in any shape or form, I try to grab it wherever I can, whether it be, you know, really trying to engage in that bedtime routine with my girls. We do this little thing every night called the sleeping game, which is a little mindfulness-based breathing exercise. And I savour that. I enjoy that type of stuff, and they do too. Whether it be catching 2 minutes with my mom in Scotland on FaceTime before I take the kids to school, you know, chatting with my husband when he comes in, whatever way I can grab connection, I try to do that, because we need it. And when our bids for connection are met, then we feel good. Do you know, it's a normal human process. And following on from what I said earlier, I think self-care and self-compassion are hugely important. Anything that nourishes us, replenishes our energy, builds us up, you know, puts a wee bit of gas back in our tank, then I think I'm all for that. And most importantly, being okay with that. You know, we would never dream of saying to a friend that she was being indulgent or it was unnecessary for her to sleep or to move a little bit or to eat well. But we tend to put those negative self-critical evaluations on ourselves. So I would say, please be compassionate with yourself. As I said earlier, we need to write as many permission slips as we need to in a day to allow ourselves to acknowledge that and do that.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yes, I think they're all wonderful, wonderful tips. And I'm going to go and practice a bit of self-compassion before I rush off, because I've had two podcast interviews this morning and I'm giving a presentation this afternoon. but I do get to go to the movies tonight with girlfriends. Awesome. So there's a bit of self-compassion in there. So I might go and sit in the sun now and just breathe some fresh air and relax for a few minutes before I launch off into my busy afternoon. But thank you for everything you have shared with us today, Laura. I have thoroughly enjoyed it, and I know there's a heap of great stuff in there for our listeners around, you know, not only being more self-compassionate, but understanding our thoughts and feelings, allowing us to feel them when we need to, but know that we don't need to get hooked into them, that we don't need to allow them to become all-encompassing. Some great resources there that I'll pop in the show notes too. Where can our listeners find you online? You have a website, yes?
I do. It's a work in progress at the minute. It's been rebranded. It's thesweetlife.co.nz. Mm-hmm. I also have a Facebook and Instagram feed, and you can check me out there. On my social media handle is @thesweetlifepsychology.
Beautiful. Okay, we will put all of that. And you said that you are there's big things to come with The Sweet Life. I assume that's in the online space as well as in the offline space.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So hopefully lots of exciting things about to happen with The Sweet Life Psychology. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, look, we will make sure that all of those links are there so that people can find you and watch in anticipation for, because what I can only imagine is going to be a lot of wonderful resources for people to help to live their life at their fullest.
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful.
It's so lovely. So beautiful catching up with you, Ellen. And I want to thank you for allowing me to share this time with you.
You are very, very welcome. Thank you. Well, that was big. So many wonderful topics covered by Laura Braid from The Sweet Life. You can hear the passion she has for her work and her clients come through in every word. And she shared some really wonderful resources with us too. If Laura has inspired you to learn more about mindfulness, ACT, and psychological flexibility, you can check out those resources in the show notes for this episode. Pop over to potential.com.au/podcast to take a look. There you'll also find our guest profile sheet for Laura, which tells you a bit more about her, where to find her, and it gives you Laura's tips for well-being, happiness, and fulfilling your potential. I had a lovely surprise this week from a listener who very kindly wrote a review of the podcast in iTunes. Sydney Scribbler wrote, "I'm really enjoying these interviews, such fascinating people and subject matter." Well, that just made my heart sing, because it's my goal, with the help of my team, to highlight the wisdom and knowledge of these fascinating people and to share their expertise with you. Sounds like we're nailing it. Thanks, Sydney Scribbler. Next week's episode is our final for season one. The team and I will be taking a short break to prep for season two, and the podcast will be back bigger and better in mid-June. But before we go, my special guest for the final episode of this season will be Cassandra Dunn, psychologist, podcaster, and life coach, talking to us about shifting from crappy to happy.
You shouldn't have to spend $200 an hour and sit in a room with somebody to learn some of these things. Information should be available.
It's a great way to finish off the season. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back in your ears next week.